Hi, everybody. How are you doing? It's Boozy here with Boozy's Legal Funhouse, and per usual,
the lawyer.
That's a separate problem entirely.
Per usual, we're having issues tonight.
I figured it out.
Yeah, well, you got it? You can hear me?
I can hear you.
Wonderful. Hi, everybody. How are you doing? It's Boozy here. Let me go ahead and transition that over. For Boozy's Legal Funhouse, we got Dave Lister down at the bottom, and my special guest tonight is Feathers. That's right. Feathers Hornsby, is that it? Feathers Hornsby,
yes.
Esquire?
Correct.
Oh,
it's supposed to sound distinguished because I am not. It's
supposed to sound distinguished because you're not. Before we get going with Boozy's Legal Funhouse, at the beginning of every single one of these episodes, I have to read off the names of all of our producer level and above Patreon supporters over at patreon.com/lawyersandliquor. So a special thank you to Jarl, seventh son of Cain. Jeremy the Head Fox, Dragor, Jack of All Corgs, Nikolai, Tezcat, Magic Jag, Waylon DeRoche, Beaton, Dozer the Trash Panda, Eddie the Weather Fox, Mark Beckwar, Mama T, Uncle Kage, Ash Jeeves, Evelyn Klein, Lisa Lupe, Mark Phaedrus, Netherlynx, Pandemonium Hawk, Petrov Neutrino, Scott Skunk, Tyranth, Buddy Goodboy Esquire, CC Otter, Chroma Hydra, David Hunter, Ed B. Golly, Evie Solis, Feck, Gosio, Grace Jane Gollinger, Ian Delahorn, Jason Knight, Just Dave, Just James, Calic, Coma Blood, Paul, Mark Whipple, Michael Blocker, Sean Rabbit, The Dragon Show, Wheelie, and Zeros the Lion. Per usual, I expect anybody listening to this on their podcast service of choice who has not been adequately prepared to go, did that motherfucker just say Jarl, seventh son of Cain? We have a very varied audience here at Boozy's Legal Funhouse. And once more, as always, I have to go with the favorite part of the evening. That is the disclaimer. Boozy's Legal Funhouse is a podcast that is informational, educational, and hopefully entertaining in nature. While the people on this are licensed attorneys, we are not your attorneys. The only way we become your attorneys is if you come into our offices, sit down, consult with us, tell us about your problems. We agree to represent you. You pay us a retainer of our choosing, not your choosing. You sign an engagement letter. Only at that point will an attorney-client relationship be formed and anything that we say fall beneath it. No legal advice is given. We speak about general principles of law, not specific cases. Please, for the love of God, do not go out there and say a fat man who acts like a cartoon badger on the internet told me about this. It will not hold up in court. That said, as you may know, if you've been listening for a while, we record each of these live, and I am leaving in tonight the technical difficulties that we experienced by bringing Feathers into our little world. That is staying. Feathers, that is not going away. I am, of course, the Boozy Barrister, Boozy Badger, your host for Boozy's Legal Funhouse, a Pennsylvania licensed attorney and general raconteur. My guest this evening is a personal injury lawyer from the great state of New York, the Empire State. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name's Feathers the Purple Owl. I am here today to talk to you about all things that are not criminal. As those of you who don't know, I am a civil litigator, much like the Badger friend over here. I do not know much about crime. However, some of this stuff, such as the Fourth Amendment, will pop up because there's some intersectionality in what we do for work. What that means is there's crossover. So you may hear me babble about things like the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution, which everyone tends to think of as a criminal thing, but you can use it as a sword in the civil realm as well. I specialize in those kinds of things, civil rights violations, but I can also do your trip and falls. So you might see my face plastered on a bus or a billboard somewhere in the Queens, New York area. The bridge over my shoulder is the one I live closest to. You also will probably see my cat running around in this 625 square foot apartment. So I apologize if she's distracting in any way.
I always love it because whenever there's a new person on the show, I have to tell them two things. Number one, while we record live, this is primarily an audio podcast.
Context.
So no one out there is going to see your fucking cat if they're not tuned in tonight. Number two, it is always wonderful because so many of the lawyers that I sit and I socialize with, I'm like, hey, you want to do some stupid shit with me on a Monday night? are members of the furry fandom. So there is somebody out there who has no clue what that is. And they just heard an attorney say, I am Feathers the Purple Horned Owl. And I am certain that that, as it did when Buddy Goodboy Esquire and Scuffles D. Rat came on, just gives them such wonderful feelings about the legal profession in general. Tonight's topic is qualified immunity. That is the immunity given to public officials. However, before we get into that and discuss it more, as always, we do have to go through our legal news stories of the week. We have three legal news stories. Scuff, I sent them over to you. Did you do the required reading?
I'm not Scuffs, but try again.
Yeah, same fucking.
Yes, I did. I did do the required reading. I read all the articles, the opinion that we're going to get into. I have notes for those of you who are not watching live, because now I know that you're not watching live and can't see me holding up my notebook right here. So I have everything squared away and I am ready to go.
How little work do you have to do at your office that you said, I'm going to make notes. I'm going to be prepared for the Fat Man's podcast.
Well, do you want the honest answer? I was avoiding work. There's a difference.
I'm always happy to add into that. So our first story tonight from the ABA Journal, the maker of Snapchat can be sued for a speed filter on the service. Now, this actually has a couple moving parts in play. First, Section 230. What is Section 230? Section 230 is part of the CDA, the Communications Decency Act, that allows providers of internet services, platforms, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, to not be held liable for content posted by their users. Well, in this case, it was not content posted by the users that got people in trouble. It was content posted by Snapchat itself. Snapchat apparently has some filter out there called the speed filter that tells you how fast you're going. And they have a giant warning that says, do not operate your car while using the speed filter. So kids, being so responsible, did what responsible kids do and immediately started a rumor that if you posted things with a speed of over 100 miles per hour, you got some special rewards from Snapchat. This led to three teenagers dying after they crashed into a tree in Wisconsin going 113 miles per hour. Now, Snapchat relied on Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act to say, hey, it's not our fault. That's content they posted. At which point, the Ninth Circuit Court in California came back and said, no, that's content they posted, but it's content you put up there for them to use. We're going to let you be held liable on that. Now, Feathers, this is your jam.
It is, in a way, yes. I can safely say that I have had all manner of tech companies. The one that pops into my head is Uber. Uber has actually tried to use Section 230 against me in federal court cases in the Southern District of New York, as well as New York State Court, to say, no, 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 we are a tech company. We're not a livery cab service. Anything that we post is content that you are interacting with. So next time you have your Uber driver, think about that for a minute. You're not hailing a cab. You're interacting with a cab driver. Needless to say, I argue against that routinely and say, no, no, no. This is not a newsstand. These people are not distributing cabs. This is not technology that we're using. You are a de facto livery cab service. So with the Snapchat thing, this is the same kind of thing. You can analogize, which is what the Badger and I do for a living. You take something and you spread it really nice and really thin and see how far you can get away with it. So, well, Snapchat maybe, did the same thing.
Maybe you do that, but all of my arguments are supported by fact and evidence and law and are so clear that it would take an absolute dipshit not to see things my way.
Oh, of course, of course. In appellate courts, you've never argued in front of an appellate court in your life.
Even the law's on my side. The law's always on my side. And if the law's not on my side, then the facts are on my side. And if the facts aren't on my side, well, I just pound the shit out of that table.
Yelling always works.
Unless you're yelling this whole court's out of order, it doesn't tend to work that well in that situation. Judges don't have the what is it, few good men objection standing.
I actually lost my... I'm allowed to curse, right?
Yeah. Fuck no! You're allowed to curse.
I lost my shit the other day. Real bad. So I started screaming and yelling, and luckily, those of you, again, who can't see me... Virtual court in New York. I don't have to leave my 620 square foot cozy space to go to Staten Island anymore on the ferry. So I was in Staten Island. I said some things I shouldn't have said, and I almost said fuck, and I didn't. And I caught myself because I was actually worried that they might send the marshal to my house.
I'm sure that's the first time anybody would have said fuck in Staten Island. Yeah, that's Staten Island. When I think Puritanism and straight-laced, I think Staten Island.
Oh, there's definitely not a place where they call mafia away, where they bury bodies. No, no, no. Not a thing that happens in Staten Island. Never, ever, ever.
Moving on to our next story for the evening. This was actually pretty interesting for the fact of what it shows. Once again, from the ABA Journal, where I crib most of my news stories, a judge has gotten a public warning after eating for free at a law firm's luncheon before awarding $2 million in legal fees. A Houston judge was given a public warning because they awarded $2 million in legal fees in a case they were presiding over after that judge ate for free at a celebratory luncheon for the law firm who got the award. Judge Frederica Phillips of Texas's 61st Judicial District Court didn't tell opposing counsel about the free lunch and attended the free lunch at the invite of the law firm to celebrate the admission to the bar of several of their new lawyers. The law firm had represented a defendant who had won a case in front of the judge and then won an award of legal fees. The award of legal fees, the $2 million and the reprimand, was given based off of a $15 salad the judge ate at the award ceremony and the swearing in. The judge did not believe that this would be a problem, stating, Judge Phillips expressed her belief that given the nature of the luncheon as a celebration of new attorneys, the small price of her meal, and the very public nature of the luncheon taking place in the open at a restaurant near downtown Houston that is frequented by attorneys, she did not believe anybody could reasonably view the circumstances of the swearing-in and celebratory lunch as improper. The Judicial Ethics Commission, however, disagreed and reprimanded at the judge publicly by saying that her actions gave the impression that she was showing favoritism in awarding a $2 million fee. And it's an interesting thing to lawyers, especially because you are aware, we talked about at one point in the past on here, the lawyer's rules of professional conduct. There is actually a judicial canon of ethics. And one of the common things in the judicial canon of ethics is to avoid giving the mere appearance of impropriety in the rulings. It would be my take on this that the commission more than likely thought that the judge attending a public swearing-in celebration for a law firm with a case pending before her court, and then slightly after receiving a free lunch, awarding $2 million in fees to said firm, gave the appearance of favoritism and impropriety, whether or not it was accurate. Feathers, thoughts?
One might say there's no such thing as a free lunch. I've been waiting to use that all day. The thing that people don't realize about these kinds of things is it is the key word that we need to zoom in on is appearance. It's not actual. It's not intent, which we'll get into later. It's the appearance of impropriety. Doesn't matter what her intent was. The judge went, sat at a lunch and said, there's a bunch of new lawyers. This is wonderful. I'm in public. My salad is $15, it's not a big deal, and ate her salad and went on her way. However, it's the appearance of impropriety. A plus B can be inferred to be C. You're striking up against those ethics rules for judges as well as for attorneys. So we need to be very, very careful with those kinds of things. I clerked for a judge for 2 years. He wouldn't accept anything from anybody. No campaign contributions. No, I tried to buy him when I left. Tried to buy him lunch in Manhattan. And even for me to do that, somebody who worked for him and was paid, he said, no, because I don't want somebody seeing us. And if you work for a private firm later on, I don't want them saying, oh, that's payback for the steak.
Right. And it really does come into private things, because these judges, they don't exist in a vacuum. A judge does not spring fully formed from the head of some judicial Zeus out there. The judges were all attorneys at one point in time. They were members, most likely, of their local bars where they're presiding. They knew the other lawyers. They worked with the other lawyers. Maybe, and we run into this in my area a lot, they were members of firms that are going to be hearing cases in front of them. And when you have that, you already have this background, sort of. You already have this thought, well, the judge likes Bob a hell of a lot more than he likes me. So maybe the judge is skewing towards Bob. And that is why it's so important to avoid that appearance. I have had clients that have come to believe a judge is skewed against them because the opposing firm is the firm the judge worked for 10 years ago before they took the bench.
I've had venues actually have to be changed. So there are upstate counties in New York, Rockland, Westchester, Nassau County in Long Island, where we have friends who practice. And if they have stock holdings, I've brought cases against large corporate entities where they have holdings in stock for the real estate company or for whoever I might be suing. And, you know, Time Warner owns a building in Manhattan, or another owner of another building. And I have gotten to the point where I have exhausted every single judge in that particular county, and they've said, sorry, we don't have a judge for you. You need to go to a different county and find venue elsewhere. What a venue is where you're holding your trial, where your case will be litigated. So a lot of times you can run the well dry because these judges are so, so careful to avoid the appearance of impropriety, because God forbid somebody finds out they own stock in AOL from 1992. AOL Time Warner.
I will say I have had cases in small counties, and the judge took the bench, looked at the defendant, looked at me, and said, full disclosure, I know the defendant. You know, 20 years ago, they did work on my parents' farm, and I'm aware of them. I believe I can be impartial, but if you would like me to recuse myself, I will. And of course, in that situation, what do you don't necessarily go, no, judge, we're sure you can't be impartial. As a matter of fact, as I told my client, they're like, why didn't you ask the judge to recuse himself? I'm like, for all we know, they did shitty work on the barn. But that's it. I actually do have a question from the chat, and we normally take these at the end, but while we're on the topic, Dr. Quox has asked, how far have you had to go in the case of a venue change? I am assuming geographically from where you are.
Well, that's the thing. So I'm going to make, without getting into the complicated right. answer, New York City is composed of 5 boroughs. Each borough is a county. So you can move certain things within New York City and be 18, 19 miles from somewhere else. So because we're so well connected with mass transit, the excuse that it's too far, which is forum non-convenience and some other things, basically saying this is too inconvenient for me to even come here, doesn't really apply within New York City. So something might go from the Bronx to Staten Island, for instance, or from the Bronx to Manhattan. So those things are distance-wise 25 miles apart because the city is large. But the farthest I've ever actually had to go was Dutchess County in upstate New York, where I went to college, out to Long Island, to Suffolk County, out in the Hamptons and Riverhead. That's the farthest I've ever had to go. And yes, it's inconvenient, and yes, it stinks, because there's a reason you bring certain cases in certain venues. But that's a distance of probably about 4 hours in a car, 2 hours and another 2 out east. So 4 or 5 hours in a car.
You didn't just bill the client for a hotel room?
Contingency, my friend, contingency. I am not permitted to bill.
You see, that's the difference. I don't take shit on contingency. Because you know what contingency says to me? If your case is shit, I'm not getting paid. And staying on the topic of judges and the appearances they give, this one comes from Fox 2 Detroit. A Detroit judge scolded a construction worker for showing up to court wearing a t-shirt during a virtual hearing. Detroit Judge Ronald Giles stated to a defendant who showed up at a virtual hearing wearing a t-shirt from their construction job site, "I don't do sweats and I don't do t-shirts in my courtroom." When the defendant said, "Hey man, I'm at work," the judge did not give a shit, basically stating, "If you come to court, you dress for court, because in my court, if you don't dress for court, I'm gonna dress you," which sounds like a really fucking weird threat. Which means
until you get the context for it, right? Yes.
Which means I send you to the Wayne County Jail and let them dress you. Apparently, there was a hero in the hearing that day because some unknown woman spoke up during the judge's tirade and stated that while not a defendant or a witness, and she doesn't know the man, she thought it was a problem for the judge to be saying that while this man was appearing from his work site for a court hearing. Now, while this judge is not being disciplined, he is being talked to by William McConico, the chief judge of that district court, who stated, "It's not a good look for the court, and that's not normally how cases are conducted. A lot of judges would have made an exception because his work attire is construction. This is my work attire, you're in yours. We're all in different professions. I love this quote, though, from McConico. "I don't know if they even know who the person was who was advocating for him." That's still a cliffhanger right now. We could be here all night telling horror stories of judges and their courtroom policies and procedures. I think the thing to take away is the judge is like a little god in their courtroom a lot of the times. And they will tell you how they expect you to dress. And you'll have people who show up wearing t-shirts to court. And if you're like me and you deal with the public, you may have a collection of Goodwill button-ups in the back of your car and tell your clients to appear at court early so that you can see what they're wearing and then hand them a button-up and say, "No, put this on."
Yeah, I used to have, back when we had offices and the world wasn't ending, I had we called it the Susie suit closet, which is you would have suits of varying waists and chests and all these different things that had patches and the elbows were worn through, but it was at least a suit. So you would bring it, you get on the train, you go up to the Bronx, you go wherever you're going, and you would know, because you've had this client in depositions, they've been with you for years, that they're going to show up in sweatpants. They're going to show up in sweatpants with spaghetti stains. They're going to show up with wearing whatever they want to. And you know Judge X doesn't tolerate that. So you'd hand them the suit and say, "Get in the stall and change. Wear it over your clothes. Do whatever you have to do." And they'd show up in their Nikes with the spaghetti stains and with the kitty litter on it and stained from, you know, diapers and God knows what else. But they'd at least be wearing a suit.
The story that I have for, and hey, it's not just clients, like lawyers show up underdressed too. There are some courts where the judge doesn't care if you're wearing a tie. Yeah, you can walk in dressed like I am right now, slacks, button up.
I wore this to court this morning.
Yeah, throw on
certain
a blazer.
Judges don't care.
The judge doesn't care. They know you're there for a real quick thing. You're in, you're out. They don't give a shit. There's other judges, when you show up in front of them, suit and tie. You are in a suit and tie every time. And they will actually say, "You're a lawyer? Yeah. Where's your tie?" Lawyers who appear in front of me wear ties.
I've gotten yelled at years ago, 6 or 7 inches of snow. I wore boots. As a judge in Long Island City, Queens, where you can see the Manhattan skyline, beautiful, right on the water there. But people who were in front of that judge, I was a new lawyer at the time, knew you don't wear boots. They had garbage bags over their dress shoes. You need to wear dress shoes. I came in front of a room full of 200 attorneys. Go home, come back at 2, and wear your shoes.
Now, I have to ask, because we're on this topic, do you have the emergency suit?
I do.
Every lawyer has an emergency suit. It is normally, it's one of your older suits. You keep it either in the trunk of your car or hanging on the back of your office door. It is the full nine yards. It's a dress shirt, suit pants, suit jacket, tie. They're normally some of the oldest ones you have, and you have a pair of dress shoes somewhere in your office or vehicle.
And it's got to be something that's not flashy.
Yeah.
It's black and white and black shoes and, yeah, and dress socks.
It is specifically for you get called into court and you know the judge is going to require you to wear a suit, but you didn't wear a suit that day because you weren't planning on fucking being there.
110%. I've yet to meet a lawyer who doesn't have one.
So, and that is because I have one in my trunk. I have one on the door. I actually have a blazer and tie on the coat rack walking into my office. And people are like, oh, you wear that in and take it off every day. And I say, no, I leave that sitting there until I need it. I have a pair of dress shoes sitting in the corner of my office with socks shoved in them. And Feathers, you've seen my office. Oh, my God.
Yes.
My leaning tower of malpractice there on the side of my desk. I call it that.
But that's the case you don't want to touch. It makes its way from your desk to your file cabinet, to inside the file cabinet, to between the two file cabinets, to behind the file cabinet, to underneath the file cabinet, to propping up your desk when it's uneven.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I jokingly call it my leaning tower of malpractice. The truth is, I know what's in the pile. I know where everything is in the pile. I have given our cleaning service strict instructions not to touch the pile. But it's like the active lawyer filing system of I'm done with it, throw it on the pile. Oh, so that brings us pretty much up to tonight's topic, which is qualified immunity. Now, I'm going to give the textbook definition of qualified immunity. And the thing you have to understand is the federal government and state and local governments for a long time didn't allow themselves to be sued. And officials acting for that government couldn't be sued. It was a concept called sovereign immunity. The sovereign cannot be brought to answer to court. It's a holdover from the old English common law principles. Well, when we put in the 14th Amendment, when we put in Section 1983 of the United States Code, and I'll let Feathers talk a bit more about that because he is definitely more experienced than I do.
My favorite. Claims.
When we put those in, what we said was, you know what? We shouldn't make it so officials of the government can't be sued no matter what. There should be circumstances where we can sue these people, even if they are ostensibly acting in the course of their employment. Back in 1982, though, the Supreme Court sort of addressed this concept, because you can imagine the problem if every police officer got sued every time they issued a ticket, saying maybe they were a little too aggressive when giving the ticket. You can imagine that issue, right? Personal experience, I got a ticket on my way home tonight. I'm one of those lazy people. I didn't take my car to be inspected in a timely manner. We have a real young hotshot cop in the town I live in. He's become very familiar with me over the past few months. Not in a professional capacity. He has become very familiar with me over the past, like appearing in front of the district court for things.
He still wrote you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He does not like me.
Oh,
he
so
does.
That
yeah,
way
no, he,
like,
yeah,
hey, how you doing?
Like, he is deferential to me, but he does not fucking like me. But he saw my tags were expired at the red light. He pulled me over. I was pulled into a gas station to get gas. He pulled it behind me. I'm like, here we go. So he wrote me for that. And I'm just kind of like, he's like, well, this is expired. That's expired. I'm like, well, that's not expired. I renewed that 5 minutes ago when I saw you pulling in behind me. So he's like, shit. So he wrote me for that, which is no big deal. It's literally, I told him the truth, which is my mechanic's been closed for the better part of a year now because it's a two-man shop and one of their parents died of COVID. And he said, oh, no, that's fine, you know, this and that. While I'm sitting there, and this is me going off topic, while I'm sitting there, a hit and run happened directly in front of us. And the car takes off, and he's sitting there, and he doesn't know what to do.
He didn't get in the car and go?
He didn't get in the car and go. He didn't know what to do. And the people who got hit are like, they're right there. They just went up that road. You can catch them. He's like, but I've got someone pulled over. And I'm like, go get them. I'll wait, man. Go get those people.
Give me the summons. I'll go.
But they wrote it. And as he's getting cussed out now by these other people who just the person who hit their car just got away. And he walks over and he hands it to me and he's looking miserable at this point. I'm thinking, yeah, that's karma for you. I said, it was I saw the type of car and I saw the driver and I gave him a description of both. And he said, how'd you see that? I'm going, well, I was sitting here. I didn't have much else to look at. So he thanked me and basically said, he goes, you know, if you get inspected before the court date, I'll dismiss it. I said, yeah, I didn't. Okay.
Thanks for doing me that sound.
Yeah, thanks. I've got to get it inspected this week anyways. I had the appointment to get it done on Thursday. So, but anyways, as I was saying, now that I'm done with my divergence from that, for my little bit of boozy drama for the day, when they put qualified immunity in, it was back in 1982, Harlow v. Fitzgerald. It's a United States Supreme Court case. And what they basically said was that qualified immunity should be a legal principle that shields government officials performing discretionary functions from liability for civil damages insofar as their conduct does not violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. That is the direct quote from the case. What it means is a little different. What it means is that if a government official acts in what they believe is a reasonable manner, and they violate a constitutional right, but think they are entitled to because of the facts or the circumstances, they should not be civilly liable for it. They should not individually need to be sued. That was the principle of it. And on paper, right off the bat, it doesn't sound like a bad principle. It does.
Subjective inquiry. That is the important thing to realize. A lot of this, and not to cut my friend off.
No.
A lot of this is when we use standards in tort law, which is someone hurts me and I want money. If you use those standards, they're very different. Most of the time we use what's called a reasonably prudent person standard. What that is Captain Buzzkill. Captain Buzzkill drives the speed limit. Captain Buzzkill always stops when there's a yellow light. Captain Buzzkill doesn't trespass on other people's property. Captain Buzzkill does everything that you're supposed to do. And Captain Buzzkill is my friend, because Captain Buzzkill holds people to an almost impossible standard to meet. And if you deviate from that standard, that's what we call negligence, right? They were negligent. They should have done something and they didn't do it. Here, in this instance, with qualified immunity, we defer to police officers and other government actors to use their subjective experience training to say, this wasn't a clearly established right for other members of my profession, whether it be police officers, consular officers, TSA people at the airport. They have a subjective standard. I believe, and other members of my profession believe, that I was allowed to search that laptop. I was allowed to do, we're going to hear about it later, shoot at that dog. I was allowed to do these things because X, Y, and Z. And I should be accorded the benefit of my subjective thought process and my subjective inquiry because I am acting in a government function.
Now, I mentioned a moment ago, and no, it's perfectly fine to interrupt me because I was about to say, I mentioned a moment ago section 1983, and I think it's important before we proceed that people know what section 1983 is.
The carve-out, statutory carve-out. So, essentially, what section, it's 18 U.S.C. 1983, like Boozy was speaking about before, as a general rule, the federal government and government state actors are not permitted to be sued unless they avail themselves of such a exception to the immunity, which 1983 is a federal law which permits and allows suits in equity, which means you can get injunctions and things like that, suits at law, which are contract lawsuits and things like that, and negligence lawsuits, where somebody did something they shouldn't have done, or violations, and this is the important bit for what we're talking about, constitutional violations to be adjudicated for money damages. This is not just something where you should stop doing this. There's been plenty of 1983 actions brought against the New York City Police Department to stop them from doing things like enforcing quotas on traffic tickets. They've brought things under that provision of federal law to stop, to have a court order saying, this is unconstitutional, you should stop doing this. But what we're talking about for the case that we're talking about now, or going to be talking about, Corbett, it's money damages, right? You violated my rights, and I need money. Now, there's something called the vindication of rights, which is actually up in the Supreme Court, recently decided by Chief Justice John Roberts, which kind of messed me up. I can't recall the case, but basically saying that adjudicating cases and saying that you damaged my rights, right? The court says, yes, you violated someone's constitutional rights, and I got a dollar. The jury awards me a dollar. That's an adjudication on what's called the merits, meaning this person walks away feeling fuzzy and warm. They might not get the money they want, but they feel fuzzy and warm. So that's your backdrop. You have this shield if you're the government, and you can do whatever you really want to do in your subjective opinion, so long as you're acting in the government interest and you're acting in your government capacity. Unless you run afoul of 1983, unless you violate someone's constitutional rights, unless you breach a contract, unless you do something that someone wants a court order to stop you from doing, like an injunction. So that's our backdrop. We have this shield, and then we have a statutory exception to that shield.
Now, the real purpose of qualified immunity was actually clarified by the Supreme Court back in 2009 in the case Pearson v. Callahan. And in Pearson v. Callahan, it really did set forth the two distinct purposes that are supposed to be served by the concept of qualified immunity, by granting government officials a shield from personal liability. The first one was a need to hold public officials accountable for irresponsible exercises of their power. But the second was a need to shield officials when they perform duties reasonably. Those are the two competing interests at play in any qualified immunity analysis. And like I said, it sounds like a pretty reasonable way to look at things until you get down to cases underlying that decision, like Malley v. Briggs. It's a 1986 SCOTUS opinion that basically said qualified immunity is intended to protect all but the plainly incompetent are those who knowingly violate the law. And it sounds good, but that's a broad area of protection.
It's a high bar. And I cannot explain with enough emphasis how many times I have lost motions for summary judgment with that line quoted right before the wherefore clause that says this person's case is dismissed. It is an extremely high bar to meet. Incompetence is incompetence. It's not subjective anymore. And this is the problem, in my professional opinion, as a plaintiff's lawyer who chases ambulances, with the statute. The statute's great. The interpretation and the common law that's come out of it, the cases that have come out of it, have raised the bar so much so that qualified immunity isn't so qualified anymore. It's become a de facto immunity for anything and everything.
Here would be a good example of qualified immunity applying as intended, okay? And keep in mind, those two standards, the need to hold public officials accountable for irresponsible actions and the need to shield them. A firefighter is called to a kitchen fire in a house that has no one home and breaks down the door to get in. Should that firefighter be sued for the damage to the property, the breaking down of the door? Of course not. That is not an irresponsible exercise of power. There are constitutional protections at play. You have one of the highest levels of constitutional protection against government action inside your own home, but it's a reasonable exercise of that power. That is the type of action that you could arguably say is intended to be protected by qualified immunity. We often speak of qualified immunity solely in the context of the police, because that's where it comes up the most. Quite frankly, it's where it comes up the most. But qualified immunity applies to all government officials, all government servants, not just the police. A firefighter takes someone out of their home in a fire to get them out, in the process injuring them, say breaking their leg. Should they be able to be sued for that? Qualified immunity would say not if they acted reasonably. But if they pitched them out of an 8-story window when there were other ways to get down that they were aware of, qualified immunity probably shouldn't protect them. That's not a reasonable exercise. In theory, in pure theory, at the basis level of the two competing interests, qualified immunity is not necessarily bad. What has made it bad is how it has been interpreted over the years and applied. Back in 1982, when Harlow was doing that, they said a clearly established law. All right, and that's a clearly established constitutional law. And what is that? Well, Harlow had said that a clearly established law exists when it is sufficiently cleared that every reasonable official would have understood they were violating the rights. Right at the offset, they fucked that theory up. Because it's not any reasonable official would have known they were violating a right, but every reasonable official, anybody put in that place, would have. And there's been mixed guidance on what constitutes a clearly established law, which we're going to get into here in a few.
Separate prongs.
Oh, yeah.
A few separate tests that you could use as to what defines clearly established. I have a few different cases that I'll get into from my personal experience that most of you will find either harrowing or funny. It depends which side of the cynical aisle you happen to be on.
And qualified immunity, though, really as put in there, is it's unfair right at the beginning of it. First of all, qualified immunity is an affirmative defense. And an affirmative defense is essentially the yeah, but I still win of the law world. It is, even if everything these people said is true, I still win because X. X being the affirmative defense. Affirmative defenses are things like self-defense in a murder. Yes, I murdered them, but self-defense applied. Therefore, even though I shot him in the head, because I did it in self-defense, I'm not guilty. Necessity, or in a civil matter, you know, yes, I broke down the door, but I had to save the baby that was playing with the loaded gun.
Those, the car accident, a good one that we have here, is called the emergency doctrine. You are driving a motor vehicle on a highway. A tree falls on your side of the highway. You have to swerve into oncoming traffic, head-on collision with the other vehicle coming the other way. I wasn't negligent. I acted reasonably in response to an emergency. I'm not liable.
And in the case of affirmative defenses, for you, for me, for Feathers, for your mother, if you have an affirmative defense, it is your burden to prove it. You have to show that you meet the requirements, all of the elements of that affirmative defense in response. It's not the same for qualified immunity. Most courts require that the plaintiff, the person who is suing, establish that qualified immunity doesn't apply when they are going against a government official. What does that mean? Logically, it means that the courts assume your government officials, your police officers, your firemen, always act reasonably. It gives them, at the outset, that benefit of the doubt in a civil matter, and requires, if qualified immunity is raised, and it almost always is, requires the plaintiff to show it does not apply. They must disprove the defense rather than requiring them to prove it. And what must they show? Well, first, they have to show that there's a violation of a constitutional right. They have to show there is some right out there that has been violated by this official. And then they have to show that the right was clearly established. And that doesn't mean like saying, of course I have a Fourth Amendment right. You know, it's right there in the Constitution. It's clearly established. But rather, that the action that is leading to the harm, the action that was undertaken by that public official, was not reasonable. That's what's really meant by a clearly established right. The right exists, and the action clearly was an unreasonable violation of that right. Because there are limitations to your constitutional rights. You can have a constitutional right, have it violated, and have it violated reasonably, depending on the circumstances.
You can give an instance, sort of, segue. One of my clients was a paranoid schizophrenic who was a messenger carrier. I'm sure some of you have seen that in New York City when you want to deliver something important or serve papers. There are guys with messenger bags that hop on bikes and weave in and out of traffic and do a bunch of things they probably shouldn't be doing. But he went into the subway, and then voices started telling him there were demons in his bag. And the police officers decided that a man swinging a messenger bag with dumbbells in the bottom of it for some reason was not the right thing to do. They told him to put the bag down. There's video of this because everyone has a tiny computer with a camera. And he is precipitously kicked, like a mule kick, I would say, into one of the subway stanchions. It's a big metal thing that holds up the ceiling for the subway. And he has a bunch of fractured teeth, a fractured orbital, and a piece of his orbital bone, which is the bone that holds your eye in, was actually broken such that his optic nerve got severed. So he could not see out of his left eye as a result of this. Now, in my loss on this case, the court found that the police officer's use of force in that case was reasonable to protect the public from the imminent danger posed by a paranoid schizophrenic man swinging what he admitted to be 15 pounds of dumbbells in a bag plus some papers. So that's what you mean. And that's how it should work. I wasn't surprised at that outcome. I wasn't distraught. But that's how qualified immunity is designed to work. What we're going to talk about here in this case is how it goes sideways.
To give you an idea, because before we get into it, you have to understand, I'm cribbing from a couple of cases here when I read this part. Because you did notes, I did notes too, motherfucker. Clearly established in theory means that the contours of the right are sufficiently clear that a reasonable official would have known the action violates it. That's almost a direct quote from Anderson v. Creighton, another United States Supreme Court case from 1987. Notably, while ostensibly this does not mean an action must have previously been held to be unlawful to be apparent, this can end up being the result. In some circuits, officials may not even be required to draw analogies from previously decided cases and say, well, this situation isn't A, but it's enough like A that A probably applies here. They're not required to do that in some circuits. They can say, nope, A's factually distinct. We have a different set of facts here. And that further narrows what you would know is going to be not subject to qualified immunity. And why does that matter? Because in Hope v. Pelzer in 2002, the United States Supreme Court essentially stated that the purpose of qualified immunity, the way that you overcome it, is where the facts and circumstances and prior law places the official on notice that their actions are violating a constitutional right, a clearly established constitutional right. In Hope, they designed a three-pronged test, okay? And I'll turn it over to Feathers after I read through the three prongs, because Feathers is going to be much better at describing what each of these mean than I am. But first is, was there a materially similar case that has already been decided? Is there a case that is so close in the facts and in the circumstances that it obviously applies? Was there a broader, more established principle that should have placed them on notice, that controls novel facts, that would require some obvious clarity of it from it? Or you can show that the that the case fits within conduct that is always going to be so unreasonable that it violates a constitutional norm, or as the court in Hope put it, conduct that every officer would expect to establish or to violate a clearly established constitutional right. Showing any of those three can, in theory, get you over qualified immunity. Feathers, what's the problem with those three prongs?
The problem with those three prongs is they are subjective and they are extremely hard to find. I am going to use the first thing, and I am cheating. I'm actually looking at Hope right now, so everyone knows I'm cheating. The first prong is the materially similar case that's already been decided. And as Boozy said, this is something where you have a fact set that is nearly identical or something you can analogize. Problem with that is most things aren't nearly identical, and you have to scour the world to find things. So let's talk about prong one. Materially similar is I can get the way that I think of things is cases that I've had, right? So I had a case where a client of mine was running through a brook. A brook is a body of water that moves and does not have any sort of obstruction in it, but it's not deep, but not shallow either. And a thicket is something different. And I learned this when I lost. A thicket is a brook that has brambles or other thorny appurtenances. And I'm quoting now because it's burned in my brain. And my client was in a cemetery that bordered Brooklyn and Queens. He was running from the police officers who had saw him rob a store. They shot him in the leg. I could not find any cases in the Southern District of New York, which is where I was suing the NYPD, or the Eastern District of New York, or any other district in the United States that is similar to that fact pattern where someone was shot in a cemetery in a brook. The court, in telling me that qualified immunity applied to my client's case and the cops were free to shoot him in the leg, decided that because a brook is not a thicket, the case that I found was a thicket. It had brambles. It was like Splash Mountain. That's the best way I could think of it, to be honest with you. It has thorns and things that you can get caught on. Because of that difference, my client's right to not get shot in the leg when he was running away and posed no danger to these officers was not a clearly established right and was not materially similar. So that is what prong one is. So this is not an escape hatch that's easily utilized. This is something that, you know, textualists like Antonin Scalia, the late Antonin Scalia, would say, oh, no, a brook's not a thicket. Sorry, you're out of luck. These are the things that make you win and lose in these 1983 cases. Words like thicket and brook. That's prong one.
And to give you an idea, prong two, it's not a broad principle. It's not like you can't shoot pets. They don't occur. And prong three is literally, instead of the firefighter kicking in your door to put out the fire, it's the firefighter breaking into your house when there's no fire, but he's on the clock and chopping your leg off in your sleep for no reason. Those are the standards, folks. That's what we apply. Really, that first one is the most important one. As the 11th Circuit said, the 11th Circuit actually stated, if case law in factual terms has not staked out a bright line, qualified immunity almost always protects. A bright line in law means We have already established this. There are no questions. There is no wiggle room. We have already established this specific thing is not okay. Let me give you a case. This is the case that I sent over to our good friend Feathers earlier today. It's one of my favorite ones, especially to bring up. It's a 2017 case decided by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in 2019. In this case, the police were searching for a suspect. Okay? The police were called out to what I assume, just from how things are worded, was a mobile home. A mobile home park. And they were trying to apprehend a criminal suspect named Christopher Barnett. The people who were there had never met him. He wandered into the area of their home where one adult and six minor children were outside playing in the yard. Another adult and two other minors were inside the home. The police came into the yard and demanded all the people in the area, including children, get on the ground. They handcuffed one of the adults and put a gun to his back. The children were outnumbered by the police officers, and there were at least four of them who had guns aimed at them. While the children were on the ground, the family dog was outside near one of them. The plaintiffs have stated, and you have to remember, when these are brought up, they're normally brought up on motions of defense, so we accept as true, for the purposes of the court, we accept as true all of the allegations of the complaint. The plaintiffs stated the dog was not threatening and did not advance on the officer. These are the facts that the court was considering. Whether they would later be borne out at trial or not is a different question, but not one at issue for the purposes of what we're talking about. We accept it as true. The officer fired his gun at the dog. He missed the first shot. The dog went under the home. No police officer, and obviously none of the people held on the ground with guns pointed at their backs because the police had walked onto their property looking for a suspect they'd never met before, went to go get the dog. The dog came back out from under the house and approached his owners, including the little boy. Remember, all of these people are on the ground and handcuffed. The police officer shot at the dog a second time. He missed, and he hit a 10-year-old in the knee. At the time the child was shot, he was on the ground, he was compliant, he was face down. The fleeing suspect the police were chasing was visibly unarmed and readily compliant. The court accepted as fact for the purposes of this analysis, that at no time did the shot child or any other child present any threat or danger to provoke the officer to fire two shots.
Neither did the dog.
They then state that the parties do not dispute that the officer intended to shoot the dog, not the child. When this case went in front of the district court, the officers moved to dismiss it on the grounds of qualified immunity, saying, we cannot be held personally liable for this. The plaintiffs said, no. It's very clear they shouldn't have shot at a non-threatening dog to hit a child. That's outside the scope of any reasonable officer. We should be allowed to proceed. The district court agreed. The district court said, we'll allow this case to go forward, officers. We're not going to give you qualified immunity on these facts alone. A denial of qualified immunity, unlike many other orders, is readily appealable. Okay, typically, in appeals, you have to wait for a final order. A denial at this stage With qualified immunity, though, can be immediately appealed up. And that's what the police did. They appealed it up to the 11th Circuit, who looked at it and obviously said, no, of course, you're chasing a fleeing suspect who's readily compliant and unarmed. There was no reason for you to put children on the ground. The dog wasn't threatening you. Why'd you shoot at the dog? Of course you could be sued. I'm just kidding. I am just kidding.
Jokes on you, people.
Because what the 11th Circuit actually said was, we've never seen a case like this before. In fact, in so holding, they relied on two recent Supreme Court cases, White v. Pauley, that said specific facts matter in excessive force cases, and City of Escondido v. Emmons, where excessive force is alleged, specific cases are more likely to be required. And in investigating those, they said that in all the other cases out there where the police had used excessive force, excessive non-lethal force on somebody, they had intended to use it on that person.
The intention, subjectivity matters in these inquiries. What the officer intended to do matters in this inquiry. The fact that they couldn't find another case like this. I could talk for the next 20 years about how many times I've been told, this is not that, sorry, go home.
So, for the purposes of qualified immunity in the 11th Circuit, if you shoot at a non-threatening dog, or even a non-threatening person, and a police officer shooting at a non-threatening person misses and hits an innocent bystander, qualified immunity applies.
Even though, and there was a threshold question that we didn't really get into, but whether or not you're seized for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment, because the Fourth Amendment protects you from unreasonable searches and seizures, which is the predicate constitutional right that comes in here. Whether or not you're seized, that means you are not free to leave. The court found that the infant plaintiff here, the injured child with the knee, the 10-year-old, was seized, even though they weren't searching for that child. That's something that I also found interesting, because you can be seized as a bystander, as somebody who's walking by or happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. This happened in New York City in the pat-down cases, when Giuliani said to everybody, you know, you look suspicious, we're going to pat you down. A lot of people, they would close stations down and they'd pat you down, or they'd detain you and say, no, you have to go over here. We're gonna do the stop and frisk on you, even though you need to catch your train home. So that was something I thought was interesting, because in my line of work, I'm in the Second Circuit. I don't practice in the 11th, but the Second Circuit does the same kind of thing where they agree and say, no, you're a bystander, wrong place, wrong time. You are still seized. Then we have to look and say, okay, you're seized now, so the constitutional right applies to you. Was the officer's conduct reasonable? And that reasonableness is a direct line to whether or not qualified immunity applies. But don't forget, we have that double burden. Is it reasonable for you to be searched? Is it reasonable for you to be shot? Because the use of lethal force is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And then you have that double burden. Is it subjectively reasonable for the officer, in his training, experience, and with other officers, to shoot at a non-lethal dog who's very clearly scared of the first shot hiding under the house? The 11th Circuit says, yes, that was reasonable.
And let me ask, say it's not a dog. Say that they had denied qualified immunity this time. And say the next time it's a cat. Would that make a difference?
It makes a difference, because dogs are not cats. Because they'll sit there and they'll say, a dog is not a cat. And they'll look at that cat and they'll, speaking of cats over my shoulder, you guys can't see, but over my shoulder, dogs are not cats. So yes, that matters. They'll say, there's no such thing as what's called a rule of general applicability in 1983 qualified immunity cases. You can't sit there and say, these things are all dangerous. All angry dogs that bare their teeth are dangerous. Again, I have to use an example. I had a client who lived in Staten Island, actually, and the police were chasing a bunch of kids who were pool hopping. and they thought it was a good idea to use tasers on these children, but instead were running over the, and I know this is horrible, but we're fence hopping after these kids, and my client was outside smoking a cigarette with his dog. The dog had no history of being angry, but bared his teeth at anyone who was not the owner when they got within a certain radius of the dog. In granting the motion to dismiss my case with a man who was shot in the face with a taser, had a pacemaker, and as a result, one of his arteries got calcified due to the pacemaker misfiring because a officer shot him in the face with a taser because he was catching kids pool hopping, the court decided that even though this dog was calm and had no history of anything like that, we need to look specifically at this case with a man who got shot in the face with a taser. And because you, Mr. So-and-so from Staten Island, can't prove to us that that's clearly established to not be shot in the face with a taser when people are pool hopping, you need to go home and try again. We're very sorry that you needed a bypass.
Let me just get, because it's not that different on the base level, on the purposes of the standards we use for other professionals. Okay. Me losing a case is not legal malpractice. Me losing a case by not doing something every reasonable attorney would do is, I can't be sued because I lose your case. Your doctor can't be sued because something had a bad result that they did. But when they act outside of a reasonable person standard in that place, in that time, in that profession, that's when we open ourselves up to liability. But what standard do we use for other professions? It's not this subjective standard.
It's objective.
We use an objective standard. What would a reasonable lawyer do? What would a reasonable doctor do? If your doctor goes in and decides halfway through the surgery for shits and giggles they're going to cut off three of your toes, we don't say, well, no doctor's ever been held liable for it before, so I guess you can walk. But that's the standard we've created for the police.
It's the boiling down of it. That's an extremely good example that I'm probably going to steal. Because you don't have those things. Everybody can think of a car accident. You can sit there and say, that light's red. You're not supposed to blow it. You know, it's the logic that underpins everything we do as a society is completely turned on its head when you get to qualified immunity. We don't sit there and say, oh, well, we've never seen a polka-dotted New York City taxi cab blow a red light. So sorry, you don't get to recover. He blew a red light. He wasn't acting reasonably. Yeah, he should pay. We don't do that to cops. And the entire rationale is we want to give them some sort of flexibility when they're acting. And you'll hear conservative radio hosts, you'll hear a lot of people say, then cops can't do their jobs. If they can't make these split-second decisions to shoot at a dog, they can't do their jobs. That's not the way this is intended to work. And it's become Frankenstein's monster. And it, because it is judge-made law, it can only be fixed by judges in overturning these decisions and these rules.
And you have to kind of ask questions about that part, too. How do we overturn it? Well, it's SCOTUS-made law. It's more than judge-made law. This is SCOTUS-made
exactly.
law. And that
it's a matter of constitutional law.
And that means that the only people who can really overturn it is the Supreme Court of the United States. And they would do that by going against stare decisis, which we have held as a very sacrosanct thing, except in cases of clear injustice. Dred Scott.
Korematsu.
And
very recently.
Yeah. And it opens up almost for people like me who are dyed-in-the-wool liberals. It opens up almost a can of worms, because once you say, well, we can overrule stare decisis for this, you know that the other side's going to jump on that motherfucker with both hands and wring the life out of it to get whatever they want shoved through. So what really is the solution? Well, believe it or not, we do have, if you're like me and on the left side, believe qualified immunity is bullshit. We should just force cops to put in an insurance bond or force departments or police unions to insure their members against these things rather than arguing qualified immunity and giving them some higher level of protection when we've already given them the ability to legally kill people. I'm sorry, but when they say, like, well, cops will be second-guessing, if your job has you holding a gun with the ability to shoot another human being, I want you second-guessing shit. I'm sorry, I do. That's something I want.
The other thing that comes into it is they'll say, well, there's no other way. I had to shoot at that dog. I felt, subjectivity, I felt that I was in fear for my life. With all of these children on the ground, handcuffed. Everyone's handcuffed. That dog was gonna get me, and I was in fear for my life. So this just goes to show you how much deference our government, our culture, and our laws give to police officers and people who enforce the law.
If you or I said, I feared for my life, so I had to shoot them, we would call that imperfect self-defense. And while it may mitigate, it would not relieve us from liability. Now, honestly, very honestly, an unlikely supporter to the rolling back, if not abolition, of qualified immunity can be found on the Supreme Court right now in the form of Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas has written several times now that he would like the court to revisit the concept of qualified immunity to roll back the protections to protect only against the sort of torts that are intended by the common law under the constitutionalist founding and not be as broad as it is. I would argue we can get the fuck rid of it and make police officers and departments and unions do what every other profession that's supposed to be held to a higher standard due to our position in the service we render other people do, and buy fucking insurance.
Correct. New York City, where I live and work, has already done so. And I have been litigating cases against the NYPD in state court. And I'm going to pose this to you, my friend. And I want to know what if you were representing a police officer who had shot someone, and a case was brought in New York State Court, and you know that qualified immunity is not a thing that exists in New York State, in the city of New York, and you know the NYPD is at home there, what would be the first thing you would do, either procedurally or on a motion to dismiss in state court, to make sure qualified immunity is still a thing, even though statutorily it doesn't exist in the city of New York? Little thought experiments for your listeners here.
Procedurally, I'd try to get the matter removed up to federal court.
Why might you do that?
Well, because it's not a state court matter, but 1983 claims are federal claims with concurrent jurisdiction between the two.
Correct.
And so it's still a thing federally.
Here's what happened. I've sued in New York State Court for those things and said in the city of New York, County of Kings, which is Brooklyn, there is no such thing as qualified immunity. Promptly been removed to the Eastern District of New York, federal court. I have also had motions for summary judgment and motions to dismiss, arguing that federal law preempts the state law on this issue because the federal law says 1983 gives government actors, not 1983, I'm sorry, qualified immunity gives government actors immunity. And the state cannot trample on something that is directly on point with federal law. Those issues are still being litigated.
If you're a little confused, by the way, about two episodes ago, I had Buddy Goodboy Esquire on, and we discussed Law Supreme with Fries, which was the order of laws and what courts have jurisdictions over what matters. And what we're talking about now is an argument that the federal courts, the federal law, always controls issues of qualified immunity versus the state law, and whether there is really concurrent jurisdiction between the state and the federal courts on this matter.
Correct. And people like me are the people who are fighting these things and saying, no, 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 the state law controls. And I'll say, no, 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 federal law controls. And I am sure as shit going to end up in the Second Circuit on the case that was removed. And it's going to be a classic law school Erie doctrine, is this thing preempted or not problem. Or is this case truly removable? Because there's some cases from the Court of Appeals in the state of New York up in Albany that say state courts are empowered to decide questions of federal law and state law. So we stay tuned, folks.
On that, we're got to turn to Discord because our Patreon supporters every week are invited to ask questions of us while we are talking and see what's out there. But before we do, hey, Feathers?
Yes, sir?
Finer than frog hair!
I hate when he does that. Oh, my God. It hits my funny bone somewhere over here. Oh, nice sweat stain.
God knows how long ago we were having a conversation, and I was telling them about Southern sayings, and I came out with that one, and this motherfucker lost his mind.
I can tell you exactly when it was, because it was over the summer, and we were doing Megaplex as like a Laurie Horror Stories. It was like 2 in the morning, and we were all shit-faced, and he just came out with that, and I lost it. Belly laugh. Almost falling on the floor.
So this is from Quaxima Fetida. It is a qualified immunity question, so to speak. Are private security firms imbued with any form of qualified immunity? How about civilian auxiliaries of military or police, e.g. the Civil Air Patrol? I can answer the first part. No. Qualified immunity is only for government actors. As to the second part, the answer is it depends. Are they acting in a government role at that time? Are they acting under the authority of the government? There is plenty of case law out there saying that a government actor is a government actor when they are acting on behalf of or under the control of the government. Theoretically, could that make them liable and then have qualified immunity applied to them? Certainly, I don't see why not. If you have a Blackwater security agent under the control of the federal government, they could take on the cloak of the state and possibly claim qualified immunity.
I've had it happen with paramedics and doctors. There will be people who are physicians who are in Times Square, for instance. This happened to me where the FDNY is removing someone and they do something stupid and somebody ends up with paralysis, cervical paralysis. And a doctor says, I'm a doctor. And they tell him, do CPR on that person. And he does it. He pushes too hard and actually causes a sternal fracture in his sternum. That little bone fragment goes in and ping-pongs around the rest of his body, causes internal bleeding. The pressure causes other things. And long story short, this gentleman had to have a spinal cord operation that rendered him paralyzed from his neck down. The court determined that that private physician was acting under the direction and control of the fire department of the city of New York. And in granting the motion to dismiss my client's case, found that qualified immunity was extended to that physician for that reason.
We have from Plot Bunny Farm. Does qualified immunity apply to non-cop government employees, say map makers? Yes. Qualified immunity applies to all government officials. Okay. The key is A, are they a government official, obviously, but B, is it a constitutional violation? Find me the constitutional violation from a cartographer, please. That is so clearly established as being a violation that is unreasonable. But no, in theory, yes, qualified immunity can apply to any government official. The reason we see it with people like the police as much as we do with those types of officials is because those are the ones whose actions are going to have the highest chance of violating a constitutionally protected right on a day-to-day basis. We don't give firefighters handguns. We don't give paramedics pepper spray and tasers and nightsticks. They may have them, but you typically don't issue them. Those are the government officials who are most likely to violate your constitutional rights and those protected rights, and to do so in a way that would bring qualified immunity into play. But in theory, it applies to every government official. We actually, like, when I say qualified immunity, I should be clear. We already have immunity for most government officials that fall under sovereign immunity. And for the vast majority of government officials, they're not going to have tort claims brought against them.
Unless it falls under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which Correct. Is another another thing for another time.
But from the vast majority of government officials, they're not going to be subject to tort claims, and especially not in their individual capacity on those. And to a large extent, qualified immunity won't apply to government officials who are acting in violation of the law, such that sovereign immunity would not apply because they're obviously in those situations not acting as agents of the government at the time they act. And that is something that you do have to hold in mind, is this only applies when they are acting as an agent of government. If a cop shoots you off duty at the gas station because you get in an argument with him, he doesn't get to claim qualified immunity. He wasn't on duty unless he can somehow claim it was part of his official role as a government actor. The same thing, and you probably would not be able to sue the police department for that in many cases, because he's not acting as their agent at that time. Doesn't stop people from trying, just it's not likely to be held.
It's not something that if it came across my desk, I would take it. You just kind of sit there and say, no, that sounds like an individual dispute with an officer who doesn't have insurance. So go away, please. No money for me.
Let's see. We had a similar question from Jeremy the Head Fox, and who was asking if members of the National Guard, when out on deployment, would be held to that standard. And that's actually a good question. My gut says yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's absolutely. I've never come across it, and I know that's going to be weird for most of you listening because I do have examples for most things. However, National Guard would fall under the auspices of the government. They're government actors when they're deployed. Government actors when they're doing their practices, the weekends that they go out and do their training. I don't have a case like this, but I have a colleague that does, where someone got shot by a National Guardsman who was shooting in shooting practice, and the bullet went into someone's yard and killed someone. So they are actually acting in a government capacity even when they're doing training exercises.
So that is kind of the whole McGillicuddy for our overview of qualified immunity. Feathers, do you have anything to add?
No, I just want to thank everyone for letting me be here, for letting me nerd out a little bit. I want to thank you, my friend, for having me.
Hey,
it means a lot to me. I get very, very excited, in case you can't all tell, about all this nerdy stuff. And I know it seems like I lose quite a bit, but I'm on the front lines of this stuff, and I really enjoy it. And it's my hope that maybe one day soon, you'll see my name on some of the Second Circuit stuff and some of these appeals, and maybe, just maybe, I could change the landscape. Because, you know, that's how and why some of us do what we do, is to change this stuff. Because I think it's not something that should be happening, and I think it's become Frankenstein's monster. That's the best way I can describe it, is a hodgepodge of ideas that had the best of intentions and wound up being totally and utterly going sideways.
I love that, letting you nerd. I don't know if you all have picked up when you're listening to these or not, but everybody that comes on here is a huge law nerd like I am. They are the people who just get something like, oh, the law. And then we just kind of fucking go into that little green alien from Toy Story thing, you know, sitting around staring up at Corbin's on contracts or something as it's being lifted into the sky above us. Feathers, thank you so much for being here. Folks, that has been our talk on qualified immunity. We're probably going to name this one Cops Get One Free Bite. just because I'm that type of guy. I am your host, the Boozy Barrister, Boozy Badger. If you like the stuff you hear, you can always tune in. Every Wednesday, we go live on your favorite podcast service, and every Monday night at 7 p.m., we record live over on the Twitch channel. If you want to support us, you can do that over at patreon.com/lawyersandliquor. And if you don't want to, that's fine. Feel free to say, "Fat man, you're not getting my money," and just come back next time. I am Boozy. This has been Feathers. Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody.